what I hope and what I think should have emerged from the lectures that we've been through is that if we look at the period carefully, and if we look in particular less at formal declarations and more at actual practice, that the difference between regimes which have been labeled by historians constitutional or absolutist are actually differences of degree and not really differences of kind. I wouldn't want to suggest that there were no differences among the states of Western and Central Europe, and it's certainly true that there were greater institutional restraints in England and in the Netherlands on the power of the central government than obtained in France, Austria, or Spain. Nevertheless, it seems to me that in both constitutional regimes and in absolutist regimes, the very clear lesson of the 16th and the 17th centuries was that no monarch, no matter how powerful he might be, could afford to ignore the religious convictions of the political nation. And this brings me to a second point, which is that it's really in this sense that the monarchy could not afford to ignore or trample on, certainly, the religious convictions of the political nation. It's in this sense that all of the wars that we reviewed really were wars of religion. It should be stressed that already in the late 16th century, there are observers, perhaps most famously Michel de Montaigne, who would assert that the wars of religion weren't really wars about religion after all. Most of the soldiers in question had no grasp of religious theology and had no real religious convictions. Indeed, to just take one random example, Spanish interrogations in the Netherlands would reveal that so-called Calvinist radicals often had only a shaky grasp on Calvin's theology. But what I'd like to stress is that this is, in a sense, besides the point. Religion in early modern Europe was much more than a philosophical system for understanding how humankind would be reconciled to God. It was also, above all, through ritual, through ceremony, through religious institutions, it was a way of expressing, indeed a way of enacting, the human community itself in this world. It was a way of expressing the identity that communities felt. It was a way of expressing their own nature, and in particular, it's a way of demarcating their boundaries. There's a sense in which, certainly by 1700, Frenchness has come to be identified with being Catholic in the same way that Englishness has come to be identified with being Protestant. It seems to me, when talking about wars of religion and the relationship between religion and politics, that it's a further irony that in the 16th and 17th centuries, it was above all religious zealots who generated that language of individual rights and responsible government that remains an integral part of the Western tradition. In fact, what's interesting is that if you turn that observation around, it's above all people who theorize absolutism in the early modern period who are willing to advocate religious toleration. And it's not hard to see how those two things go together. It's religious zealots who are convinced that they have a higher calling to God that allows them to override the claims of the monarchy on their loyalty. These kinds of people, zealots, one might on some occasions be tempted to call them bigots, are perhaps not people with whom modern Western liberals might want to associate themselves, but nonetheless, in terms of the analytic concepts, in terms of the language that they bequeathed, that's where the modern notion of rights and responsible government comes from. A further, and I think equally significant historical pattern that we've seen in the 16th and the 17th centuries is a fairly clear relationship between an ideological consensus in matters of religion and a massive increase, a truly massive increase in the power of the state itself. Once the religious issue had been taken off the table, once it was agreed that no Protestant could sit on the throne of France and no Catholic could sit on the throne of England, the agreement, the consensus on what we might want to call the ends of state power would inspire enough confidence in the political nation to accede to a massive expansion in the means of that power. And moreover, and I think this is something which can't be ignored, this expansion of the power of the state, of the state in all these countries, normally invested the political nation itself with significant material advantage. One final observation I would like to make, and that is, it's become a cliché. It's often said that religious warfare has caused an awful lot more suffering than any other form of conflict in human history. It seems to me that at least in the European case, this is only indirectly the truth. After all, modern wars fought for secular causes have taken immeasurably more lives than were lost in early modern Europe. But it was, I think we have to remember, the 16th and the 17th centuries which bequeathed to the West the mechanism of all of these incredibly destructive wars of the 20th century, and that is to say, the modern state. It's this powerful institution with historically unparalleled powers of oversight, extraction, creation, and destruction that's perhaps the most ambiguous legacy of the wars of religion.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com. or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.